The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting over in the Welcome to Oprah Insider section. Oprah on the long walk to realizing your dreams. Don't look at how far you need to go. Look back and see how far you've come and keep going. And this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hello, insiders. When I opened the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls 17 years ago, I had the greatest hopes for every student. I knew it wasn't just a life-changing disruption for the inaugural classes of 7th and 8th graders. I told them then, and they now recognize that it changed the trajectory of what was possible. Never was that more evident than this past weekend, when Bongeka, that's her on the right in the photo below, as a young girl outside her home in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, graduated with a medical degree from Stanford University. Wow, what a journey! Our first meeting was in fall of 2006. I didn't know then that she had summoned every English word she knew to get through the final interview with Gail and me. We interviewed 500 girls and chose 75 seventh graders and 75 eighth graders. Bongeka was in the first class of eighth graders, the first class to graduate OWLAG, the pioneers they rightfully called themselves. During the first week of orientation, I assigned all the girls Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings to do as book report. Years later, Bongeka told me that assignment not only terrified her, but she actually thought, who is this Mom O to demand such a thing? She explained to us all at this past week's celebration that she could read, but had only read in the past for memorizing material to take tests. She had never read a novel before, and had never read for pleasure. So she understood the assignment to be, memorize this book. She said after memorizing the first two pages, she realized it was going to be completely impossible to master the book's 304 pages in the 2 weeks I had given them for the assignment. After sharing her fears and frustrations with other girls, she eventually understood the assignment. Bongeka became a stellar student, improving her English along the way and graduating in the top of her class at OWLAG. She came across the ocean, adjusted to U.S. culture, and got straight A's at Spelman, and one B that had her crying for a week. After the first hour on the phone, trying to console and convince her that all grades are just markers assessing what you've attained or didn't, I gave up and said, cry yourself dry. Call me when you're done. She ended up graduating summa cum laude from Spelman in 2017 and then went to Oxford for a master's degree in medical anthropology. Really? I said. Hard to say it. Can't imagine studying it, let alone mastering it. Her big dream was always to go to Stanford for medical school. There were many trials, and learning new ways of studying and taking tests, of understanding that there's a process for preparing and passing, finding the right procedures and programs to help, and all the while she never gave up on herself. She has incredible caring and concern for patients and rave reviews and recommendations from her fellow professors and doctors in training. But she would freeze in the 8-hour exam until she found the right support. And, my, did she build a strong support system. I got to meet some of her professors and say, thank you for staying the course at our celebration dinner. She came from a village, and it's taken a different kind of village to get her to the Stanford finish line. Years ago, Nelson Mandela wrote a book called The Long Walk to Freedom. In our family, we would joke about Bongeka's long walk to a medical degree. I admire this daughter girl so much. I am so proud of her tenacity and courage to keep going. In the car, on the way to the final walk across the stage, one of the other girls asked, "Did you ever think of giving up?" She said, "Yes, but the thought of calling Mom O made it not a real question, and I would have always been disappointed in myself and wondered, what if?" The truth is, if she had called, and I'd truly believed she no longer wanted to be a doctor, I would have understood. But there's no giving up on a dream just because it's hard or didn't work out the way you planned. Never give up on yourself, your dream, and what you know is your calling. I've been teaching that to these girls since the school first opened in 2007. Mongeka is not the first doctor to graduate. Dr. Boitumelo Thiep, who remained in South Africa for her studies, was the first. Numerous girls have gotten PhDs and masters. Almost every girl that graduated OWLAG continued to college and was among the first in their family to do so. Every journey, every story, every trajectory, a victory of its own making. Bongeka standing in front of her Rondeville home, a home she still goes back to when she leaves the United States, a living, glowing example of what hope and possibility can look like when given a chance. And I stand as a proud mom and member of the village that actually got to witness her grow wings and soar. I had seen the picture above years ago before she entered Oxford, and I suggested that she use it as a screensaver to remind herself of how far she'd come and to remember that little girl with the dusty legs, that's who you're fighting for. It's a picture of two children and a little girl with a gray sweater and a little skirt, and next to her is a child in a pale blue shirt and matching shorts, and behind them it looks almost like a yurt, a round home with a grass roof that they're standing in front of. I know so many of you have had to take your own version of the long walk to realize your dreams. Some of you may still be on the path, one foot in front of the other. Don't look at how far you need to go. Look back and see how far you've come, and keep going. And please give a shout out to our latest doctor in the family, the last girl of the girls who came to the U.S. for college to understand and complete the assignment, Dr. Bongeka Zuma. There are two other pictures. At the top of the article is a picture of Oprah. She's in a blue, pale blue knit dress, and she has her arm around the shoulder of Bongeka, who's in a graduation gown with a graduation cap. And then on the bottom of the article is another picture of six women standing, three on each side, with Oprah in the center and Bongeka in the middle in the graduation gown. And all of these ladies are dressed in white or light colors and dresses and pants suits. Next, we're over in books. Read the mesmerizing opening to Oprah's 106th book club pick. In Familiaris, David Robolewski tells the story that came before his 2008 bestseller and Oprah's 66th book club pick, The Story of Edward Sawtell. This article is by Charlie Burlock. He'd been dreaming about Mary. When he woke, the new pup was standing between the Kissel's front wheels, head cocked, inspecting the still steaming puddle of radiator water. At 9 weeks old, the pup was flop-eared and square as a bison, and stout legs in a coat of brown and black fur that stood out all over his body like some exotic canine velvet. Quivering, the pup leaned forward and dabbed one outsized paw at the perimeter of the cooked mud. "You'll get your nose boiled," John Sawtell said, yawning. The The next drip strummed a stalk of timothy and splashed into the puddle. The pup leapt backward, spun, and barreled headlong into the Kissel's front wheel, back legs paddling even after his muzzle had squashed up against the tire. The pup collected himself and sat scratching his ear with his hind foot. Then he advanced on the puddle again. John squinted at him.
"Are you sure your name is Gus?" he said. "I always thought Gus was a name for a smart dog. Maybe you're a Barney, a Chester."
When he woke again, the pup lay curled against his hip, drawing long, slow breaths and making short, huffed exhalations. He'd come north the day before with a different pup entirely, the biggest and fleshiest from the litter their dog Vi had whelped in the spring, a fireball they'd dubbed Boot. Best for the best was the deal he'd made with the man, whose name was Billy Tremeau. As he'd walked off that morning calling, cradling Gus in his arms, Boot had followed, yipping and crying. John had forced himself not to console the pup. It was better if Boot turned to Billy for comfort. But the whole business left John feeling like a betrayer and a fink. All Vi's other pups, the ones they'd placed so far, were within 20 minutes' drive of the house where he and Mary lived in Hartford. But Boot would be far away at the top end of the state. This pup, Gus, weighed upward of 20 pounds already, and the warm press of his body slowed John's heartbeat. He untied the string connecting his belt to Gus's collar and shifted the pup without waking him, and stood and whacked the dust off his trousers and walked into the road. He leveled his hand over his eyes. No dust plume of an approaching automobile, no dark shimmer of a man on horseback, just the road narrowing to a brown thread that disappeared beneath the long overhang of the North Woods forest. During her geography lessons, Miss Diffie, John's fifth-grade teacher, had impressed upon her students a trick of memory, one John habitually and almost unconsciously used on his many driving trips. "Make your right hand into a plank," she told them. "Palm up, finger straight. That's Wisconsin." The Kissel had boiled over that morning on an unmarked dirt road near the top joint of his middle finger, 20 miles south of Lake Superior's rocky shore, and 100 miles north of where, 10,000 years before, glaciers had ironed the state flat. He'd had no special reason to turn down the little side road. Side roads always looked interesting to John Sauto. He enjoyed getting lost, and he enjoyed finding his way back again. Gus bumbled out from beneath the Kissel and sat on the toe of John's boot, panting.
"You're thirsty. I'm thirsty, the car's thirsty," John said.
He tugged a leather cord to extract from his pocket the Webster chronograph he'd won in a bet. The design on its case involved hundreds of curves radiating outward from a central fleur-de-lis.
10 minutes more," he told the pup. "If no one comes along by then, we'll look for a creek."
The pup looked at him. He peered around.
"All right, make you a deal. See that rock? No, not my hand, over there. If I can get all the way to that rock, we'll go now. Otherwise, we wait for the full 10. Shake on it? Hey, maybe you are a Gus."
He rummaged in the back seat of the Kissel, produced a pair of work gloves, and put them on. He touched his toes. He windmilled his arms.
"The trick is," he said.
Then he pitched forward, planted his hands on the road, and let his feet rise into the air. Gus, who in his short life had never seen anyone do a handstand, circled John, growling and trying to lick his face.
"Stop!"
John gasped. He staggered about on his palms, locating his balance point.
"You're making me get out of the..."
He wobbled through a full circle, trying to pick a reference point opposite his destination to steer by. He'd never figured out how to walk on his hands in the direction he was looking, then let his knees bend and his feet drop slightly, and went teetering off with Gus following after, leaping downward and falling upward, sticking to the road with all four paws. He meant to go straight down the middle of the road, but with Gus jumping and licking and stones grinding into his palms, he journeyed instead towards the opposite shoulder, got a close look at a stand of upside-down milkweed, turned laboriously, and crossed two canyon-like ruts that he would rather have avoided. He wasn't even halfway to the rock, and his arms were trembling. Blood was ramming his eardrums. The Webster chronograph dropped out of his pocket and began thwacking fore and aft on its cord like a metronome, hitting him in the chest, then the kidneys. Gus kept trying to grab it. Every passing second, John had to dismiss the feeling that he was about to topple. He reached the rock, then passed several yards further down the road before he let his feet drop to the ground and rolled upright. With Gus snatching at his bootlaces, he paced off the distance back to the Kissel. 63 yards. He clapped the road, dusted off his gloves, and fetched his notebook from the car, made a notation, and then drew a star next to it. He looked down the road again, hoping a fellow traveler might have materialized to witness his feat. "At least you saw it," he told Gus. But now even the pup was gone, nosing around in the weeds across the road. The Kissel had boiled over just 200 yards shy of a hilltop. John set off toward it, coaxing Gus along, expecting to see only an unbroken expanse of forest beyond. But as he neared the top, a broad field opened off to the west, and from the crest of the hill he saw down below them a farmhouse and a barn surrounded by a wide green yard.
"Well, what do you know?"
he said to Gus. The pup peered up at John as if pondering the question. What did he know? Not much, had to be admitted. Just moments ago he'd thought people only walked on their feet. The house looked unremarkable, but the barn was very large and very red. Out on the road, in front of the house, a cross-plank sign leaned out of the weeds. John couldn't quite make out what it said. It was the last Sunday in May of the year 1919. In Charlevoix County, Michigan, a few miles outside of Petoskey, a young newspaper reporter named Ernest Hemingway recently returned from a hospital in Milan, and freshly heartbroken, hobbled through his family's orchard, pinching his shrapnel scars and counting cherry blossoms. He estimated a heavy crop that fall. In West Orange, New Jersey, Thomas Edison drew the curtains of his parlor, preparing to watch for the 17th time a trip to the moon. The Georges Méliès film his employees had bootlegged from a London movie house. In Los Angeles, the astronomer Edwin Hubble, having spent the previous night at the eyepiece of the 100-inch Hooker telescope at the Mount Wilson Observatory, lay sleeping on his couch. He dreamt outlandishly of galaxies beyond the Milky Way. In a sanatorium in Scotland, W. Somerset Maugham closed the cover of Sinclair Lewis's novel Main Street, cracked the shell of a soft-boiled egg, and wrote in his journal, "But the author of Main Street has done something more than depict with accuracy the inhabitants of a small town in the Middle West, and I cannot make up my mind whether he has done it knowingly or by accident." In Nova Scotia, 8-year-old Elizabeth Bishop practiced Beethoven's Sonata No. 14 in C-sharp minor at her grandmother's piano, recently tuned. In far Rockaway, Queens, New York, the infant, Richie Feynman, draped across his mother's shoulder, contemplated the motion of the waves as they crawled unceasingly onto the sandy beach. And in northern Wisconsin, in the middle of the middle of nowhere, John Sawtell and his new pup walked down a dirt road toward a farm that would turn out to be unoccupied, and according to the cross-plank sign, for sale. All that had happened was that his car had boiled over. Now he and the pup, who would turn out to be plenty smart enough to be a Gus instead of a Barney or a Chester, were off to fetch a bucket of water so they could be on their way. He would not recognize the significance of the moment for a long time. It did not feel like the beginning of anything. The same would be true for each of the great quests in John Sautel's life. So this is an excerpt from the book Familiaris by David Robolewski, and that's Robolewski. And it's $31 at Amazon or $32 at Bookshop if you're interested in getting it. We're on the word of the week, Delulu. That's D-E-L-U-L-U. It might just be the solulu to achieving your dreams. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Delulu. Your wildest dreams can come true, at least according to Gen Z TikTokers who popularized the slang Delulu with more than 97 million posts as shorthand for being delusional, but in a fun way. Properly defined, delusional has a negative connotation and means believing something that's absolutely not true. But doesn't life feel a bit more magical when possibilities like meeting and falling in love with a celebrity or winning the lottery and never having to work again are just around the corner? Being Delulu lets you play with those beliefs without your friends actually being worried about your sanity. It's a tongue-in-cheek way to say, I know I'm being ridiculous, but I don't care. The term originally referred to parasocial relationships, a.k.a. the idea that your fave singer or Peloton instructor is your bestie, when they actually have no idea you exist. Ouch! The Delulu state can feel like a cuter, gentler way to exist. It's also kind of sort of a form of manifesting or at least self-motivating. Dreaming your biggest dream, as long as it's not harmful, can help you think about what you want out of life, and believing it can happen is the first step to achieving it. So, Delulu might actually be the Solulu after all. This next article is from the wellness section. If it's not depression or burnout, what is it? Figuring out why you might be feeling oh so blah. This article is by Corey Keyes. About a year into the global COVID-19 pandemic, Adam Grant, an organizational psychologist and best-selling author, wrote a New York Times article describing the very term I'd been quietly studying for years. His piece was called, There's a Name for the Blah You're Feeling. It's called Languishing. Grant's piece went viral, becoming the most widely read New York Times article of the year. Clearly, there was a deep need for vocabulary to describe a struggle that millions of people were experiencing, but found hard to put into words. Languishing might sound similar to depression, and both are characterized by a loss of interest in life. But there are crucial differences between the two. Depression is marked by a persistent sense of hopelessness or sadness every day, or almost every day, for at least 2 straight weeks. Often accompanied by crying spells, sleeping too much or too little, and having suicidal thoughts. Many people languishing don't meet those criteria. What about burnout? Technically speaking, that's not a mental health condition, but an occupational phenomenon that describes a mismatch between your workload and the resources you have to do it, which allows chronic stress to build up. The two conditions can feel similar at times, but burnout is a much narrower term. Languishing often sets in slowly and imperceptibly, and then suddenly you're engulfed in it. The simple question, how are you, can feel like an unwelcome pop quiz, leaving you casting about for a socially acceptable response, not quite knowing the answer yourself. How to tell if you are languishing? You might be if you find yourself nodding your head in recognition at the symptoms on this list. You feel emotionally flattened. It's hard to muster up excitement for events and milestones on the horizon. A sense of inevitability has washed over you. Your life circumstances seem increasingly dictated by external forces. You find yourself procrastinating on tasks at work and in your personal life as a "why to try anyway" attitude sets in. More and more things strike you as irrelevant, superficial, or boring. You have the constant feeling of unease that you're missing something that will make your life feel complete again, but you can't figure out what it is. You feel discontented from your own community and or a greater purpose or cause. Your job once gave you a sense of meaning or at least accomplishment, but it's starting to seem pointless in the grand scheme of things. You regularly experience brain fog. Small setbacks that you might once have weathered fairly easily leave you feeling defeated. It's hard to find the motivation to reach out to friends and family and to maintain relationships that are important to you. Your sense of self-worth is flickering or plummeting. My research on the conditions that led us out of languishing to good mental health, which I call flourishing, has found that improving our psychological, relational, and special functioning builds well-being from the ground up. Learning to hold our emotions more loosely, change the stories we tell ourselves, become more accepting of ourselves and others, and form communities of care and belonging creates a virtuous cycle, increasing our tolerance for stress, adversity, and the pressures of modern living. No simple task, you might think. Focusing on healthy functioning may require a shift in priorities, but powerful practices to ground and center yourself are among the building blocks of flourishing. And there's a book that accompanies this article. It's called Languishing: How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. And it's $21 at Amazon. And it's by Corey Keyes. And that's C-O-R-E-Y. The last name is K-E-Y-E-S. This is another article from the wellness section. A doula in your pocket. When Simone Tayette saw a gap in maternal health care in this country, she created a tech space to fill it. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. After a string of miscarriages left her reeling, Simone Tayette left her high-flying tech job to train as a doula. Tayette had worked in sales for several wellness and luxury startups before setting up a boutique consultancy agency, Heart Space NY. 3 years after training as a doula, the Massachusetts native founded Poppy Seed Health to support other women through loss, pregnancy, and postpartum, especially in rural healthcare deserts along the country. As a woman of color, Tayette is also acutely aware of the ongoing Black maternal mortality crisis and has built a space where the majority of advocates are BIPOC and all receive anti-racism training. Today, the platform connects thousands of women with doulas, midwives, and nurses who offer emotional, mental, and physical health support throughout all kinds of birthing experiences. Here's how she got off the ground. Tayette's story. In 2016, I had my first pregnancy loss. I was deeply emotional when my doctor couldn't find a heartbeat, but she just said, "Well, your body terminated the pregnancy." "It made me feel like there was something wrong with my body," she said. "It happens all the time. I'll see you in a few months when you start trying again," and left the room. And that was it. No more than a 15-minute appointment. I had no idea what the next steps were, and when I stopped by the front desk, there was no more information. Where the idea came from. I left that appointment with no medical, emotional, or mental health support. I took it to Dr. Google and stumbled onto a doula thread on Reddit, where doulas were responding to a woman who'd suffered a loss. The way that they were responding was so kind, caring, inclusive, and loving that I really started to melt into that experience and feel so much better. The phrase that stood out to me that I wish my doctor had said to me in those moments was, "This is not your fault." I was spiraling in shame and blaming myself and my body. I decided two things that night. The first one was to become a doula myself. I had a big tech job at the time, and I didn't know much about doulas. But I did know that they saved my life that evening. The second idea was for Poppy Seed Health. I wanted to create a platform to deliver on-demand emotional and mental health support to anyone who needed it, for those moments where you just need to get your feelings out. The initial goal. Our goal was to build a solution that represented the full spectrum of people who are coming into their maternal health care journey. We wanted to deliver on-demand, real person, in real-time support with doulas, midwives, and nurses responding 24/7 via text. Those people are often overlooked, but they're built-in patient advocates. First steps. When I became a doula in 2019, a wide spectrum of my clients, whether they had no insurance or the best health insurance money could buy, were asking the same questions, and everyone was lacking emotional and mental health support. I knew from 14 years of building successful startups that we needed to get close to the customer as soon as possible, to start collecting all the data points on how people really wanted something like this to work. People wanted a safe space to ask questions, to fill in the blanks between doctor visits, and to find a place to dump all their anxieties and feelings. We learned early on that our one-on-one chats were priceless, and people came to us for their own space, not group chats. Nothing like Poppy Seed Health existed before we built it. The hardest moment. After nearly 9 months or so of our scrappy MVP, minimum viable product, I knew that we were onto something strong. I had my first venture meeting in March 2020, and 4 days later, the whole world shut down because of COVID. People who were due to give birth, people who'd just gotten pregnant, and people who were in the throes of early postpartum were panicking. Thousands of people were coming to us for support. It actually helped us with fundraising because it was obvious that there was not another product like Poppy Seed Health on the market. We were innovating in a space that was really a white canvas. The moment you thought this might work. In 2020, when we were in beta, we were able to support someone in rural Arkansas who lived 4 hours away from the hospital. She came to us and said, "I'm in labor, but I don't have a car. I don't want to go to the hospital for them to just turn me away." We supported her through the first 5 hours of her labor. For us, that was our coming together moment. Sure, we're only a tech space, but the fact of the matter is that nearly 7 million people in their reproductive health care years live in health care deserts across the country, 90 miles or more from the closest doctor, hospital, or clinic. Having digital and behavioral health tools as part of the ecosystem of care is extraordinarily important, especially for this reason. Poppy Seed Health and the Black Maternal Health Crisis. I am a Black woman living through the healthcare system in our country every single day. There was no way that I was going to build something that didn't reflect solving for the biggest problems first. We know that we have an epidemic of maternal mortality with Black birthing people who are 3 to 5 times more likely to die from preventable causes in childbirth and pregnancy. It's totally unacceptable. It lights a fire in me because it could be me. That's not a fear I want to live with. I don't believe that any Black birthing person deserves to live with that fear. Our advocate network today is 55% BIPOC and 30% queer. So when you come to us, you know that we're advocates within the ecosystem who look like you, who understand, and who very much are trained to be able to support you. Every single one of our advocates goes through anti-racist training. The results. We launched the finished project in April 2021. We now have about 500 advocates available to chat anytime, and we have a wait list of nearly 1,400 people who want to become advocates. You are connected with someone within 90 seconds or less, 24/7, 365 days a year. Our conversations are an average of 37 minutes long, and they're all text-based. No one ever thinks they're going to text for that long, but it's a true testament to how strong our conversations are. We've had over 80,000 hours of chat time. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This is again in Wellness, What You Need to Know and Not Fear About Hysterectomies. The author of the new book, It's Not Hysteria, answers every question you will ever have about one of the most common procedures among women. This article is by Rosie Hopegood. Every year, over 400,000 people in the U.S. have hysterectomies. It's one of the most common surgical procedures, according to the CDC. Almost 15% of us will have one at some point. But for many, it's still a scary prospect we don't fully understand. Does the surgery remove all your reproductive organs? Does it take months to recover? Does it ruin your sex life? Here, Karen Tang, MD, a board-certified gynecologist, minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon, and author of It's Not Hysteria, answers all the questions. Does having a hysterectomy mean all your reproductive organs are removed? It did in the last century, even though technically hysterectomy means removal of the uterus. Before the 2000s, women having a hysterectomy would most often have their ovaries removed too, says Tang. And as recently as 2008, 50% of hysterectomies also included removing the ovaries, a procedure called an oophorectomy. But this two-for-one technique fell from favor as an increasing number of studies showed myriad health benefits to leaving ovaries behind. Premenopausal women who have had both ovaries removed have higher risks of cardiovascular disease and a higher overall risk of death, says Tang. The ovaries continue making some hormones even after menopause, which is important for cardiac and other health benefits. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, recommends preserving the ovaries in premenopausal women unless there's an increased risk of ovarian cancer. Who needs this procedure? This surgery is used to treat conditions such as fibroids, endometriosis, and cancer, most often the endometrial, cervical, ovarian, and uterine type, as well as serious complications related to childbirth. Most often, it's a last resort after other, less invasive treatment options have failed. It can also be given as part of gender-affirming care if having a uterus is incongruent with someone's gender identity. Older people are more likely to have had an hysterectomy. Just 2.8% of people under 44 have had the procedure, versus 41.8% over 75. Race also impacts your likelihood of having the procedure. For example, black women who suffer from fibroids and uterine cancer at higher rates than other races are more likely to undergo the surgery than other groups, according to the CDC. Is it a highly invasive surgery that leaves a big scar? Abdominal hysterectomies, where the ovaries are removed via a large incision in the lower abdomen, used to be the standard. But these days, there are less invasive options. The first is a vaginal hysterectomy, which involves removing the uterus via the vagina, leaving no scar. This is ACOG's preferred method because of the shorter surgery, hospital stay, and recovery period. But it isn't an option for all patients. for example, those with particularly large fibroids. The second is Tang's specialty, laparoscopic hysterectomy, which is conducted with the aid of a thin, flexible tube containing a camera inserted through small incisions in the abdomen. The uterus is then removed through the vagina or through the incisions itself. This type of surgery sometimes includes the use of a robotic laparoscope. Will I be on bed rest for weeks? For minimally invasive hysterectomies, the recovery time is relatively fast. You can leave the hospital that same day and resume many activities 2 to 4 weeks after surgery, says Tang. By contrast, the hospital stay can be a couple of days for abdominal surgery, and recovery time can be 2 months or more. We also tell people to avoid intercourse for 2 to 3 months because you need time for the incision in the vagina to heal, says Tang, and to avoid really strenuous exercise for 1 to 2 months to prevent discomfort or developing hernias. After that, it's just based on how you feel. Some people need longer to recover than others. Will my sex life be over? This one is a big fat nope. Studies actually show that sexual function and satisfaction either stay the same or improve after hysterectomy, says Tang. That's because people who had the operation for common reasons such as heavy bleeding, pain, or fibroids feel so much better post-surgery. They feel healthier, and that includes enjoying sex and orgasming again. This myth stems from the days when surgeons automatically would remove the ovaries, after which women would be plunged into surgical menopause, with its associated lower sex drive and vaginal dryness. If you're part of the minority of women who experience cervical orgasm as opposed to clitoral, you and your doctor can discuss having a cervix-sparing surgery known as supracervical hysterectomy. Tang notes, however, that studies show no difference in reported orgasm satisfaction for women who have their cervix left intact, pointing to just how uncommon cervical orgasms are. I've heard it can cause a pelvic organ prolapse. What is this? Each year, around 200,000 people have surgeries to treat pelvic organ prolapses, POP, which Tang describes as the dropping of the pelvic organs into the vagina or out of the body through the vagina. POPs can happen when conditions such as pregnancy, childbirth, and menopause weaken the support structures that normally hold your pelvic organs, uterus, bladder, and rectum in place. But according to Tang, it's a myth that hysterectomies cause prolapse for most people. Overall, there's not a significantly increased risk these days, she explains. During surgery, we purposely put in stitches to attach the vagina to support structures like ligaments to prevent this. However, she notes that for the 18.2% of patients who have the surgery because of an existing prolapse, there is an increased risk of worsening after the surgery. Does a hysterectomy plunge you into old age? Another one that's ovary dependent, removing the ovaries can definitely bring a noticeable change in skin and hair, but this doesn't happen with a regular hysterectomy, says Tang. Although she notes that people who have hysterectomies do develop menopausal symptoms a few years earlier on average, even when ovaries are spared, this is thought to be caused by the changes in blood flow to the ovaries after a hysterectomy, during which many small blood vessels are cut and sealed. But the right hormone replacement therapy, HRT, can make all the difference. In fact, Tang notes that having a hysterectomy opens up a lot of different options for HRT that are a little bit more convenient and a little bit safer. This is because without a uterus, you can do estrogen-only HRT. Often with HRT, you also need to take progesterone to mitigate your risk of uterine cancer. And estrogen-only HRT has been shown to lower the risk of developing breast cancer. In other words, although having a hysterectomy won't be most patients' first choice, the health benefits can potentially extend beyond the surgery itself. So this is in the relationships section. A life coach isn't a therapist. Here's how they can help you. They provide you with new tools to help you on your chosen path. This article is by Sarah Madoss. As conversations around mental health and therapy speak reach a fever pitch, you might be looking for new ways to navigate life's tough decisions and challenging transitions. Perhaps your goal is to be more confident, pivot industries, or find fulfillment in a passion project. But feelings of overwhelm or stress and decision fatigue are making it tough to figure out how to reach that goal. Enter a life coach. Consider a life coach your mentor and cheerleader. They can help you stay motivated, figure out what's blocking you, and identify your strengths and weaknesses. Nope, they aren't therapists. More on that below, but they might be just what you need. We've laid out everything you need to make an informed decision about whether a life coach is right for you. What even is a life coach? When you think of the word coach, visions of sports teams probably come to mind. Turns out life coaching isn't all that different from the world of sports coaching. They share the responsibility of identifying obstacles and finding motivation. And of course, they have the same end goal of celebrating a win. Life coaching is all about giving you scaffolding and insight on how to take your life from the present to the future you dream of. My work is really centered on four things, says Jane Scooter, certified executive coach and founder of leadership development firm, The New Exec. Helping someone expand an idea, helping someone understand what their present experience is worth mindfulness, exploring mindsets to help someone see options differently, and helping someone understand personal value and belief systems and how these show up in all areas of our lives. Just like you can find different kinds of sports coaches, there are a wide variety of coaching specialties you can look for during your search. Typically, these are listed on the coach's personal profile, practice website, or on databases like Psychology Today's. You can find coaches well-versed in sobriety, career transitions, leadership, social networking, spirituality, health, dating, and more. Life coaches use their own experiences and values to inform their work and provide services based on those factors, says Lewis Elliott, a clinical mental health counselor and certified life coach based in New York City. For example, from all my own lessons learned, I created a program to help LGBTQIA+ individuals navigate the dating landscape and build strong connections. What to expect from a session? Things usually kick off by gathering information about your background and goals so that your coach can create a program tailored to you. We usually begin with some kind of mindfulness exercise to get present, and then we discuss updates from the previous coaching session, says Elliot. Then I typically dig into their wins, barriers, and calls for healing. Finally, we discuss an option plan and close out with some affirmation. He notes that though this is the general framework, each client's sessions look different because each program is tailored to the individual. But you can always expect a mix of mindfulness, reflection, and a bit of homework. Of course, coaches will have different styles, and finding a good fit is key to getting the most out of the experience. Life coaches versus therapists. Although coaching can be therapeutic, there are major differences from therapy. A coach looks at your present to help you create the future you desire, while a therapist looks at your past to help you manage your present, explains Tess Brigham, a licensed therapist and board-certified coach. While coaching is action-oriented, therapy is insight-oriented. Perhaps the most significant difference is that a therapist can dive deeper into mental health issues. A licensed therapist is someone who has been trained, gained clinical hours supervised by professionals, and has been vetted by a board, says Angela Kenslow, a psychologist. They diagnose disorders, have the skills and tools to work with traumas, and work with short-term behavioral modifications. A life coach, on the other hand, is more of a supporter and motivator. A therapy session is often more open-ended than a coaching session. leaving more room for you to explore your thoughts, feelings, and traumas. In therapy sessions, I let my clients decide which direction they would like to go. Our conversation is usually determined by how they're feeling in that moment and what people or events may have triggered their feelings, says Brigham. While therapists are encouraged to maintain boundaries and not self-disclose too much of their lived experience during sessions, life coaches can share all of themselves with their clients, says Elliot. This can help form a positive mentor-mentee relationship. Lastly, whereas therapy might be a lifelong part of your mental health journey, coaching tends to be more short-term. Many coaches work with time-based programs, such as a 6-week or 6-month program, often tied to a specific goal or life transition, explains Elliot. What qualifications do life coaches have? It's important to know that there are no standardized education or training requirements for life coaches, which makes vulnerable people potentially susceptible to misinformation, manipulation, and simply shoddy advice. So it's incredibly important to thoroughly vet any coaches you're interested in pursuing. I always recommend some kind of training or program to new coaches to help them lean into the craft that is life coaching. But some coaches choose to just do it with their own study of self and intuition, says Elliot. There are many different training entities to help coaches develop general skills like motivational interviewing or niche skills such as tapping therapy. Look for coaches who have received training through a certifying body such as the International Coaching Federation, ICF, or Center for Credentialing and Education, CCE. Or those who also hold mental health clinician qualifications. Choosing a coach. You'll need to figure out which is right for this phase of your life. A good rule of thumb is that if your issues are disrupting your personal or professional life, you should consider working with a therapist, says Jacinta Jimenez, a psychologist and board-certified leadership coach. Remember that a life coach won't address clinical issues unless they also hold the qualifications and degrees to do so. If therapy has felt too rigid or you're looking more for a mentor experience, life coaching might be a nice option. Life coaching, like therapy, is rarely wrong for anyone, says Elliot. It's more about finding the coach or clinician that's the best fit for you. For both, you want to do your research and ask questions. Align yourself with someone who excites you, shares your values, helps you feel safe, especially if dealing with difficult emotions, and instills confidence that they can help you reach the goal you're searching to achieve. We're over in culture and news. Queen Latifah shares how Oprah inspired her positive body image. We love this supportive sisterhood. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Queen Latifah may seem like her confidence never breaks, but the star recently revealed a private struggle with her body image, and that none other than Oprah helped her push through. She spoke on the subject during the Cannes Lions Festival at a panel that touched on how obesity relates to the media. Latifah shared insights into her own relationship with weight, saying, "I watched this idea of what beauty was supposed to be, size 2, blue-eyed, that was being pushed on everyone as I was growing up. I thought that was a bar I was never going to meet. Movies and television series were undeniably dominated by that specific beauty standard." But Latifah pointed out one beacon of light that helped her see beyond that narrow image of what body should be. Oprah. Oprah's long-standing candor on weight has been a source of inspiration for Latifah. Throughout the years of The Oprah Winfrey Show and in O, The Oprah Magazine, continuing today at Oprah Daily in our The Life You Want classes. When I think of her and what she's been through on that journey, I love the idea that someone will not have to endure the same journey today, that they will be able to walk into their doctor's office and just have a conversation, Latifah said during the Cannes Lions discussion. Latifah also called out a TV special Oprah recorded in March an Oprah special, Shame, Blame, and the Weight Loss Revolution, that unpacked the topic of obesity and more with the help of medical experts. This discussion was a continuation of Oprah Daily's The State of Weight curriculum, a package featuring a conversation between Oprah and experts, as well as articles about weight loss drugs, obesity therapies, and more. And in culture and news again, Angelina Jolie on why her daughter Vivian is the reason she won her first Tony Award. Prior to the ceremony, Jolie discussed how she got involved with the Broadway production of The Outsiders. This article is by Alyssa Bailey. Oscar-winning actress Angelina Jolie got halfway to EGOT status on June 16, winning her first ever Tony Award for her work producing The Outsiders. The Broadway show won the ceremony's coveted Best Musical Award, along with three other categories: Best Direction of a Musical, Lighting Design, and Sound Design. Jolie attended the ceremony with her daughter Vivian, who served as her production assistant on the project. Jolie wore a teal Atelier Versace corset dress on the red carpet, while her daughter matched in a teal vest, pants, and a bow tie. Vivian is also the reason that Jolie got involved in the show and ultimately won a Tony. While Jolie didn't give an acceptance speech or any major press remarks, she spoke to Deadline on June 10 about the production and the big role Vivian played in it. Her comments offered a rare look into what her youngest daughter is like, who has lived her 15-year life largely out of the public eye. Jolie explained how she got involved with the project initially. "My daughter Viv loves theater. She appreciates all theater, but she certainly knows what she feels close to and what she responds to. She went to see The Outsiders at La Jolla, California, about 5 times and was telling me about it, and I had read the book and I'd seen the film years ago." Parts of this article were edited due to time. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.